And several companies are looking into the possibilities of establishing windmill facilities. Wind farms, they call them. Zisk's grin widened. What about Sam Gunn and his zero-G honeymoon hotel? That's not a form of energy technology, said Jane coolly. Zisk changed his tack. Word we get is that Astro's going to sell out to Tricontinental Oil, or maybe Yamagata. Looks to me like they won't need your help after all. Jane had a technique for hiding her surprise. She took a sip of the drink she'd been holding, then smiled as pleasantly as she could manage for the reporter, all the while thinking furiously of what her reply should be. At last she said, If that's the case, then Astro won't need the assistance my bill offers. But there are other new, struggling high-tech companies that will. Zisk nodded, his grin wider than ever. That evening, Dan was sitting in a booth at the Astro Motel bar with Claude Passot. They had shared a mediocre dinner and decided that some strong drink would be better than the desserts the restaurant offered. You must come to New Orleans, Passot said. The food is infinitely better than here. At least I got them to put in a halfway decent brandy, Dan said, swirling his tumbler of El Presidente. Passot shook his head. You should try Armagnac, Dan. Much better. Armagnac? It comes from the region of France next to Cognac, but it's smoother and better tasting. Passot placed a hand on his chest. That's my opinion, of course. Armagnac, Dan muttered. I'll have to remember that. Passot looked around the place. A couple of Hispanics were at the bar, quietly drinking beer. The barmaid was on the phone, talking intently, her free hand gesturing as if she were being hysterical in sign language. Country music seeped from the speakers set into the ceiling, some guitar strumming lament about lost love. Whatever made you decide to build your headquarters here? Passot asked. It's like the end of the earth. Dan sipped at his brandy. We can launch over the Gulf of Mexico from here. And I had an uncle who was able to sweet-talk the Parks Department into letting us lease this half of the island from the sovereign state of Texas.
Ah,
said Passot.
Money talks.
Especially when it's in unmarked bills being passed under the table. Passot laughed. You're really something of a scoundrel, aren't you? Feigning surprise, Dan replied, I didn't bribe the Parks people. My uncle did that.
And look where it got you.
It's not exactly a tropical paradise, is it? Dan admitted.
I've been to Cape Canaveral, Passot said. I thought that was run down, but this...
He waved his hand vaguely toward the bar. This will be a metropolis someday, Dan said, grinning.
Not in our lifetimes.
With a shrug, Dan conceded, Maybe not.
You worked for the Japanese, didn't you?
Yep.
Up in space?
I wasn't an astronaut, technically. I was what they call a mission specialist. In my case, it meant being a construction worker in zero gravity.
Did you like it?
Loved every minute of it. Touching his nose lightly. Even the fights. The look on Passot's face was somewhere between disbelief and fascination. Dan let him take a swallow of the scotch he was drinking, then hunched forward slightly on the booth's table and said in a lowered voice, Claude, we're ready to fly the backup spaceplane. Passot backed away slightly.
I can't authorize another test flight until we definitely prove what made the first plane crash.
We know what made it crash, sabotage.
You may believe that, Dan. As a matter of fact, I believe it myself, but we haven't any proof.
That's because the proof isn't in the wreckage.
Then where is it?
In Pete Larson's skull. Passot pulled in a breath.
Then it's permanently beyond your reach.
Look, Dan said, hunching even further over the table. Pete had access to the command codes for the plane's control systems. And he knew the ground track. He sold that information to somebody. That somebody operated a radio transmitter that sent the command to fire the nose thruster. They knew how to activate the plane's control system, and they knew where and when to do it.
But the pilot could have overridden the command.
Not during re-entry, Dan whispered urgently. Every microsecond is crucial at that point in the flight.
Hannah had just started the pitch-up maneuver that angles the plane so the heat shield on its underside takes most of the re-entry heat. Firing the thruster that pushed the nose down knocked the plane out of control. No pilot could have recovered. The plane was doomed.
Why didn't she eject?
She probably tried, Dan said.
This is all conjecture, Passo said.
If we flew the backup and nothing went wrong, that would prove that the crash was caused by sabotage, wouldn't it?
No, it wouldn't.
There could be...
I want to fly the backup, Dan insisted.
Then he added, unmanned.
Without a pilot?
Dan said, completely automatic. But this time, we keep the command codes to ourselves and we don't tell anybody what the ground track's going to be.
You can't fly like that, even unmanned, Passo objected.
There are other planes in the sky, you know. You've got to clear a flight path. Get the FAA to allow...
That's your end of the game, Claude.
I need a big swath of airspace, wide enough so the murdering sons of bitches won't know exactly where the plane's going to be on re-entry.
That's impossible.
You're asking the FAA to clear half the continent of North America for you. Just for half an hour, during the re-entry phase of the flight. While the bird's in orbit, she'll be all right.
It can't be done, Dan.
I'm sorry, but it can't be done.
You mean you won't...
Dan's cell phone began playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He grimaced, plucked the phone from his shirt pocket and flicked it open. Jane's face was on the tiny screen. She looked decidedly unhappy. Before Dan could begin to say hello, she said,
Dan, we need to talk.
With a glance at Passo, he asked, face to face?
Yes.
I could fly up to Washington for the weekend, I guess.
No, not here. At the ranch.
Dan hesitated and looked at Passo again. He was making a great show of trying to catch the eye of the barmaid, who was still gesticulating with the bar phone pressed to one ear. Lowering his voice, Dan asked,
Will Scanwell be there?
Jane said,
No, he's got to run up to New Hampshire.
Breaking into a smile, Dan said, I'll be there Saturday in time for lunch.
Jane said, Come alone,
and abruptly cut the connection. Thornton Ranch, Oklahoma. The stagger wing was too slow to suit Dan for this trip, and from the way Jane had looked on the phone, he figured that she wanted this meeting between them to be kept as secret as possible. So Dan unlocked his bottom desk drawer and fished out the driver's license, social security card, and credit card for Orville Wilbur, a phony identity he had established years earlier when credit card companies were hounding him to become their customer. He found it ridiculously easy to establish a false identity. No wonder terrorists can sneak around the country at will, Dan thought. It had started as a lark, but Dan found times when it was convenient to have an alternate persona, such as now. That Friday night, Dan drove to Corpus Christi. Orville Wilbur registered at a motel near the airport, and from the phone in his room purchased an electronic ticket from Southwest Airlines, round trip from Corpus Christi to Oklahoma City on the earliest flight out, with a commuter link to Marietta. When he got there, Orville Wilbur rented an SUV and drove out to the Thornton Ranch. As he drove through the fancy carved wooden gate of the Thornton Ranch well before noon, he saw another van some distance behind him spurting a rooster trail of dust as it followed him along the road that led to the ranch house. Security? Dan wondered. Hope it's not news media. Pulling up in front of the low, sprawling house, Dan stepped out into the late morning sunlight. It was hot and dusty, the sun high in a bright blue sky that had hardly a wisp of a cloud in it. Squinting, Dan saw contrails etching across the blue. People on their way somewhere, 6 miles above the ground. Then his eye caught the faint, ghostly image of a crescent moon, just the trace of its lopsided smile visible. I know. Dan said silently to the moon. I'm an idiot for coming out here. But what the hell? His SUV was the only car parked in front of the house. No one seemed to be stirring. The house seemed silent, empty. Dan rapped on the door and waited for someone to answer. Turning, he saw the van that had followed him growling up the gravel driveway. It crunched to a stop in a swirl of gritty dust. And Jane got out. She was dressed in jeans with a white blouse tucked into the waist,
decorated with a trio of cardinals.